You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guests this morning are Lynn Novick and Sarah Botstein, Emmy-winning documentary filmmakers and co-creators of the new Ken Burns documentary, The U.S. and the Holocaust. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Sukkot Sameach. That's right, now that the High Holy Days are completed and we have experienced the full Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur experiences, naturally the Jewish calendar launches us immediately into another major holiday, Sukkot. This is a time of great joy for Jews. Starting tonight, we begin celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot, which is actually my favorite Jewish festival, in part because it's not Yom Kippur. I also love Sukkot because of the outdoor quality, the emphasis on family, friends, guests, and enjoying life, and on its central theme of gratitude, which underlies much of what is best about religion in general and Judaism in specific. Sukkot's the 8-day-long harvest festival commemorating a holiday that is one of the truly ancient ones on any calendar. In biblical times, Sukkot, also called Sukkot, was referred to as Hechag, the holiday, as though it were the only one, and likely it was the most observed of all festivals ordained in the Torah. Sukkot's the Jewish harvest festival. We build tabernacles, sukkahs, little huts outside the house that we decorate with fruits and vegetables, and in which we eat and even sleep over the course of the holiday. It's also called Zman Simchatenu, the time of our joy, and it is filled with food, friends, and music, as well as rituals that pay tribute to our reliance upon God for the many good things in our lives. Sukkot's the Jewish Thanksgiving. In fact, the American holiday of Thanksgiving was based by the Puritan fathers on the biblical Feast of Tabernacles, or the Feast of Booths, as established in the Torah. It was particularly important for our own ancestors, whose entire lives were connected to agricultural production, farming, herding, and tending orchards and vineyards. A good harvest meant a healthy, safe winter. It was something for which to be truly grateful. The reason Sukkot was most observed of all ancient Jewish festivals was likely because it came at the right time of year. While the Torah specifies 3 separate pilgrimage festivals in which the ancient Israelites were to travel to a central place, ultimately Jerusalem, to make offerings to God, Passover in the spring, Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks in early summer, and Sukkot in the autumn, there must have been major challenges to farmers inherent on walking to Jerusalem for the first 2 of these 3 festivals. Springtime, when Pesach occurs, is a time of planting, weeding, fertilizing, doing all the hard work that eventually, God willing, results in a good crop. Early summer, when Shavuot falls, is the time of the first fruits and the early barley crop. That has to be harvested. There are many other crops still growing that need to be tended in the diverse Mediterranean agriculture of Israel. But Sukkot, it comes in the fall. All the crop yields are complete. The harvest is in. It's a time of plenty, and it was an easier time to take a week to travel to the capital and celebrate. Sukkot must have been when the greatest crowds arrived in Jerusalem, bringing agricultural bounty, making sacrificial offerings, enjoying feasts each night of the festival. The temporary huts they erected, the Sukkot they built, would have been much like the huts that they used when they stayed in the fields near the crops they were harvesting. It was a time of great joy and celebration, food, drink, conviviality, and it still is. Sukkot's the time when you are commanded to invite guests to your own sukkah, which reflects on the very structure of a sukkah. It's usually open on at least one side, so that visitors see immediately that they are welcome. In addition to the ritual commandments of sitting in the sukkah and waving the lulav and etrog, the four species with which we celebrate the festival, palm, willow, myrtle, and citron, that symbolize the agricultural nature of the holiday, we also complete the great commandment of hachnasat orchim, welcoming guests. Even luminaries from the Jewish past are invited, called ushpizin, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, and so on. Everyone is supposed to enjoy Sukkot. There's a lovely little Yiddish tune about the sukkah called Asukale by the oddly named duo of Suki and Ding.
Asukale, a kleine, vom Breitalach gemeine, hab ich mir Asukale gemacht, badeckte mit da. Bezeles kann sitz ich mir in sikle bana padekte mit da mit bezeles kann sitz ich mir in sikle bana. Lust doch die Spalten in die lächterlich sei löschen sich viel. Es ist mir achidisch, wie ich mach mir kidisch. In die lächterlich sei brennen ganz still. Es ist mir achidisch, wie ich mach mir kidisch, in die Lechterle sei brennen ganz still. Sei nicht kanal, in hab nicht kan Zeit, soll dir die nicht sein Bang. Es ist schon gut, bald 2000 Jahre in die Sikkele, sie steht noch ganz lang. Es ist schon gut, bald 2000
That was the pretty little song Asukale for the holiday of booths starting tonight. By the way, in Europe, there were homes built with a room with a retractable roof that could be turned into a kind of interior sukkah for the festival, an inside-the-house hut. By Jewish law, sukkah cannot have more than two permanent walls, so these interior sukkahs made some accommodation by constructing extra walls inside. And of course, you have to be able to see stars through the schach, the palm fronds and such on the roof. So again, you had to pull aside the roof. That speaks to the level of commitment to this holiday, and to being Jewishly observant, that entire homes were designed with a sukkah used just 8 days a year in mind. Our guests this morning, Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmakers Lynn Novick and Sarah Botstein, co-creators of the outstanding new Ken Burns documentary, The U.S. and the Holocaust, will share why this documentary is so timely and important right now. Find out when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guests this morning. They are award-winning documentary filmmakers Lynn Novick and Sarah Botstein, co-creators of The U.S. and the Holocaust, the remarkable new documentary about exactly that that's just come out. They produced it with Ken Burns. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So, why now? It's 75 years after the end of the Shoah. You guys pick your projects. You have such an incredible array of wildly successful documentaries. Why this documentary now?
The film is coming out now at a particularly opportune time for us to look back on this time in our history. It feels to us right now, but as it happens, we started thinking about this project and committed to doing it way, way back in 2015. When the world felt very different. We were approached by the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington because they were planning an initiative that we sort of launched in 2018 that was going to explore the question of Americans and the Holocaust. They were planning an exhibition and a lot of other really interesting research projects around this topic. And they wanted to know if Ken Burns, Sarah, and I would be interested in making a documentary exploring these same questions. And we said yes to the project then. We had other projects that we were already involved in, including our series on the Vietnam War and a number of other films. So we didn't really turn to our full attention to it until 2017, 2018. Our exhibition went up. Our film is just coming out now. And we were extremely grateful to have the opportunity to collaborate with the curators who organized the exhibition, the research team at the museum, and then to do our own research along with our writer, Jeff Ward. So that's a long answer to a question, but it's only because the film does seem so relevant to everything that we're living through at this moment.
Right.
And some of the things in particular that are of great concern to us today sort of were happening all around us as we were making the film.
There must have been kind of an extraordinary feeling. Here you are making a film about events from the 1930s, the buildup to the Holocaust, the deep anti-Semitism in the State Department, which you illustrate quite clearly, and America First, Charles Lindbergh, and all America First, right? That must have resonated as you were making the film.
Yeah, I think, as Lynn was just saying, I don't think that Lynn, Jeff, Ken, our editors or I would have possibly imagined how relevant the film would feel when we set out to make it. And having said that, I think the themes that the film highlights and the struggles that Americans wrestle with about what kind of a country we are always there in almost any project we do. But for this film in particular, that dynamic definitely was surprising and gave the film a meaning and urgency we did not expect.
We will continue this conversation with Lynn Novick and Sarah Botstein, the co-creators with Ken Burns of the new documentary, The U.S. and the Holocaust, when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, celebrates a fabulous array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the whole metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. For more information, Religious School is going for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, north side of Ina, west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Come in person Friday night and Saturday morning, or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, for Shabbat evening celebration services. Friday nights at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning services are at 10 a.m., preceded at 9 a.m. by Torah study, all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access all of those through the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format too, some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha to attend services, our religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and of course, all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing congregation in all of Arizona in its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, TooJewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 175,000 downloads on Podbean. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to our podcast. All of those great comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Started talking last week about Amsterdam and its famous and important Jewish community, but really the whole Jewish community of the Netherlands. You got us through the Middle Ages up to, 1500s. A lot of Jews fled the expulsion, didn't have a lot of choice, 1492 from Spain, 1497 from Portugal, the next year from Navarre. Many of them came to the Low Countries. Tell us why.
Well, They came, but they came eventually. It's not like they got on trains or planes and were there the next day. A lot didn't arrive until the end of the 1500s, like fully 100 years after the decree. But they created both a kind of golden age for Dutch Jewry and a golden age ultimately for the Netherlands. The Netherlands reached probably the peak of its prosperity and global importance at the end of the 1600s. And they did so by building a huge maritime empire.
Unbelievable.
That included North America, Central America, South America, South Africa, Asia, Southeast Asia, and all of Indonesia, of which the capital was then known as Batavia, until after independence in 1945, when the capital became Jakarta. So this empire made the Netherlands one of the richest countries in Europe, and also ultimately made the port of Rotterdam the busiest port in Europe, by far. I mean, the second port doesn't even come close. And where were the largest Jewish communities outside of Amsterdam? Rotterdam. And today, in any case, in The Hague, which is actually the capital of the Netherlands. Technically, there's like a commercial capital, which is Amsterdam, and a political capital, which is The Hague. But The Hague, Rotterdam, and Amsterdam collectively account for at least 90% of modern Dutch Jewry. Now, who were some of the Jews who made the Netherlands famous for us? Well, one obviously was Benedict, known in Hebrew as Baruch Spinoza, who was one of the fathers of the Enlightenment and who taught essentially that God is in everything. And this was regarded as heretical not only by the Christian community, but also by the Jewish community. And he was excommunicated by both for teaching these views.
Yeah, the good part for Spinoza is he had a profession as a lens grinder, which paid him very well. And he didn't need to be part of the Jewish community to function. So he was able to keep doing philosophy.
Right, right. And he was a major philosopher who was credited in part with bringing on the Enlightenment, which was the final sort of Europe-wide triumph of reason over faith, and which weakened considerably the position of any organized religion. Then when most Americans think of famous Dutch people, they think of Rembrandt and Van Gogh, two great painters, but they should also think of a young girl named Anne Frank, whose diary, which she wrote while being hidden by non-Jews behind a secret wall in their apartment in Amsterdam when the Nazis invaded, that diary became one of the best-known books of the 20th century. And it is, in and of itself, the reason many people travel to Amsterdam.
You know, it's a fascinating Jewish community. There are some other aspects, but maybe we can talk about next time. Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The rabbi was so addicted to golf that he snuck out to play between the morning and afternoon services on Yom Kippur. In heaven, Moses said, "A disgrace, a Jew playing golf on Yom Kippur and a rabbi to boot." God responded, "I'm going to teach him a lesson." On the course, the rabbi stepped up to the first tee and bombed his drive right down the fairway. His ball ricocheted off a sprinkler head, a cart path, a bunker rake, hit the green, bounced four times, and rolled into the cup. "This is how you teach him a lesson, God? He got a hole in one." "Sure," says God, "but who's he going to tell?" Well, at least he won't have to buy drinks for anybody. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles or Booths, is easy to overlook in the context of the fast flow of fall festivals. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur are followed just 4 days later by the Harvest Holiday, whose principal observances seem to be based in earlier ages. The agricultural celebration of bringing in the fruits, vegetables, and grains that carry us through a barren winter. In today's world, where food comes from across the globe, and virtually any kind of produce is available year-round in America, a particular week celebrating reaping the rewards of the natural world might seem archaic. But in recent years, the tendency towards seeking locally sourced produce and grains, produced using sustainable agricultural methods from native seeds, and finding fruits, vegetables, and other natural products at farmers' markets and through growers' cooperatives testifies to an understanding that what we produce from the ground nearby, with God's help, is the best food to eat and to serve to our children. There's nothing tastier than ripe, fresh vegetables and fruits, harvested recently at the proper time and season. They taste better. They offer many health and environmental benefits as well for us and for the planet. Perhaps that's just the way God intended us to live. For our ancestors in ancient Israel, Sukkot was considered the most important observance of all, Hechag, the holiday. Of all the festivals, this is the one most often referred to in the Bible. It must have been the one on which most people came to Jerusalem to express their gratitude to God. Sukkot in ancient Jerusalem had to have been a remarkable scene. Sukkahs all over the city, songs, feasts for the whole week. We are commanded in the Torah readings for this week, build a temporary booth, a sukkah, dwell there, celebrate there the entire week. Today, our focus on Sukkot is on thanksgiving to God for the bounty of the harvest. This season, the Zman Simchatenu, the time of our joy, is blessed with Torah readings that primarily focus on the rituals of the ancient festival itself, with some additional mystical passages. Here, too, the Torah reminds us we exist solely through the grace of God, and we offer thanks for the natural world God created to help provide for our needs. A good reminder this week and always. When we come back on Too Jewish, our terrific guests this morning, Emmy-winning documentary filmmakers Lynn Novick and Sarah Botstein, co-creators of the new Ken Burns documentary, The U.S. and the Holocaust, tell us just what it meant to them as Jews to work on this extraordinary project. Find out when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In Iran, they've learned that when you are in trouble for being evil, do a traditional thing. Blame the Jews. In finally addressing the protests against the repression of women that have for 2 weeks roiled Iran, its supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, blamed Israel and the United States for the unrest. I openly state that the recent riots and unrest in Iran were schemes designed by the U.S., the usurping fake Zionist regime, their mercenaries, and some treasonous Iranians abroad who helped them, Khamenei said in a speech to police cadets in Tehran, remarks that were posted in English on his official Twitter account. Oh, joy. The protests that have engulfed Iran since September 17th were sparked by the death in custody of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old, arrested for not properly wearing a headscarf. There have been hundreds of arrests, and state TV has reported over 40 deaths of protesters and police. Iran's brutal, repressive regime has been working overtime to move women's rights back to the Middle Ages, or worse. It is clearly failing, and its misogynistic brutality is opening it up to riots in the streets and international condemnation. So, of course, Khamenei blames Israel. Khamenei didn't offer any evidence to back up his assertion, other than to claim that protests in other countries do not garner as much international attention and condemnation, Well, if they're in Israel, they sure do, but okay. Khamenei heads a regime that has for decades backed the destruction of Israel and lends logistical support to terror groups and some of Israel's worst enemies. Simultaneous demonstrations in support of the Iran protests took place all around the world last week. In Iran, protests were reported both in universities and on the streets of the country, including Tehran, Karaj, Shiraz, Mashhad, Tabriz, Jarom, Isfahan, and Urmia. Among other locations, protesters chanted "Death to the dictator" and "Not Gaza, not Lebanon, my life for Iran," among other slogans. In one protest at Tehran University, students chanted at paramilitary forces, "We will fight and die and take Iran back." Videos on social media show primary and secondary schools throughout Iran joining the protests as well, including one of the schoolgirls in Shiraz chanting "Death to the dictator," and others of schoolgirls taking off their hijabs, waving them in the air, and ripping up photos of Khamenei. In other news, optimism over last weekend that Israel and Lebanon were inching closer to agreeing to a U.S.-brokered deal demarcating a maritime border over disputed gas fields in the Mediterranean has waned after domestic criticism in both countries. It was reported that Lebanon's government would not agree to hold an official signing ceremony for any deal. They're, I think, still officially at war with Israel. And if there was an agreement, it would be delivered to a UN representative in the presence of U.S. envoy Amos Hochstein in a room without Israeli representation. And after the Israeli side signed it, the agreement would immediately enter into force. Meanwhile, former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, locked in a closely fought general election campaign that will be held in less than a month, accused the current Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid of signing over the country's natural resources to Lebanon and Hezbollah. In a series of tweets aimed at framing Lapid as weak on national security, Netanyahu's Likud party wrote that the prime minister was handing a huge Israeli gas reserve to Hezbollah, something Netanyahu never agreed to. If signed, a maritime deal could prove a milestone in the relationship between Israel and Lebanon. It would dramatically reduce tensions between the countries and allow both sides, in particular cash-strapped Lebanon, to capitalize on huge natural gas discoveries off the coast in the Mediterranean. The current draft deal, only 10 pages long, has been in the making for years, but it ground to a halt in 2020 over Lebanese demands over a previously undisputed part of Israel's waters. Since Lebanon dropped those maximal demands, it's now Netanyahu's toxic rhetoric that might scuttle the deal on the Israeli side. Hezbollah, appearing to drop its former fervent opposition to any deal, described recent developments around the U.S. proposal as a very important step. And last week, Parliamentary Speaker Nabih Berri, a powerful Hezbollah ally, also deemed it positive in a marked change of tone for the terror group, which scuttled the agreement in 2020. Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid has taken a risk pushing this deal during the tight Israeli national election race. In addition, Israel's Defense Minister Benny Gantz has urged Netanyahu to refrain from comments that endanger the deal, but, of course, that hasn't worked. Israeli gas exports are already connected to a series of pipelines with Jordan and particularly Egypt, and may in the future also include Lebanon. Israeli gas, while not in itself a game-changer, would help the EU manage its looming energy crisis during the Russian-Ukrainian war. The backers of the gas deal in Israel see it as prospectively locking Hezbollah into an economic agreement that would reduce its room for maneuver on the political front and maybe limit its military options. For its part, Hezbollah's softened stance towards an agreement reflects new realities the group faces: a shattered Lebanese economy, crumbling public and private institutions, and the effects of fighting for 10 years in Syria, which have damaged the group. Although the Lebanese say it's nothing and they are not really talking to Israel, you can't ignore the reality. There is a kind of agreement between two countries who have had hostile relations since their respective establishment. That's from Orna Mizrahi of the Israeli think tank, the Institute for National Security Studies. Well, we will watch and hope. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world.
Our brothers, our brothers.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guests this morning, Lynn Novick and Sarah Botstein, the co-creators with Ken Burns of the new and very important documentary, The U.S. and the Holocaust. I have to admit that the Civil War documentary changed my life because I was a Civil War nerd and I didn't know that anybody else cared. So
it changed Ken Burns' life too.
Indeed it did. You know, the idea that documentaries could capture something that had been covered oh so thoroughly in so many ways and reshape the way people thought about things, I don't know that any of us understood it so well when that came out. What was the greatest surprise in creating the U.S. and the Holocaust, and which aspect of it do you think has the potential to change minds, to change the way people think now?
You know, that's a hard question to answer, partly because even though we are all students of American history and we've made a film series about America's experience during the Second World War and we have personal interest in this topic, apart from that, we still really didn't know as much about it as you might think. And that's true for all the films we make, that we pick topics that we want to learn about rather than things we already know, you know, what the story is going to be. So for each of us in different ways, there were many, many, many surprises. The film begins with one of the first surprises, which is that we found out while we were working on this project early on that Anne Frank's family had tried to come to the United States. Right. And when we discovered, research came to light that we availed ourselves of documents that showed that Otto Frank had been trying to get visas for the family. And that was quite astonishing to us because it connected the question of what United States' response to the Holocaust was to Anne Frank, whereas starting the project, we had no idea there was any connection. And it helped us to kind of anchor our story to some degree for an American audience to show that things that happened far away are connected to what was going on here in the United States at that time.
I mean, it's a little stunning. The whole Diary of Anne Frank never happens if the United States has a little bit different attitude towards immigration at that point.
That's right. Yeah. Go ahead, Sarah. Sorry. No, it was very surprising for us to learn that. Surprising it's not more well known and not taught in the context of so many discussions we have about refugee immigration, the mythology around this topic in particular. And that also led us, and I think Lynn and I have talked quite a bit about this, that it puts the whole story of Anne Frank into a different context for an American audience, and then as filmmakers set us on a journey to explore Anne Frank differently than, I don't think we would have thought to include Anne Frank if we hadn't learned that, and then in doing so, met another family that was in hiding
in Amsterdam and later is connected to Anne Frank in ways we don't want to spoil for anybody listening.
Right.
And then a conversation about the meaning of that diary and what is important about it and what is important to think about when you're studying it when it comes to the subject of the Holocaust.
You all have been immersed in American history in a way that, you know, some of us just kind of play at. These two themes, the idea that America is a country of immigrants and that we don't want anybody else to come over here, play out over the course of U.S. and the Holocaust. Do you think those are just ongoing elements in the American character?
It's hard to argue with that, given what we've learned. It seems pretty clear to us, having worked on this film and I think gotten a deeper understanding of sort of what those tensions are and how they played out in this most tragic way during the time when there were so many people trying to escape from Nazi persecution and they were not welcomed here. You know, how is that possible? We really had to ask ourselves that, frankly. And, you know, we had to really dig deep to understand that for most of our history, we did have open borders and there were restrictions here and there, but, and particularly the Chinese Exclusion Act in the 19th century, but millions of people came here because it was a refuge, because it was a place of opportunity and asylum. And then all of a sudden it wasn't. And that was in 1924 when we passed this very draconian Immigration Restriction Act. And the purpose of that was to keep people out who came from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, because the people who really had power in America didn't want any more immigrants coming from places where they thought the people that came from those places really didn't belong here, ultimately. And yet, we are a nation of immigrants. So there's a reality that is true, and then there's an impulse to close the door, and that tension is ongoing, as we see all around us.
I mean, obviously, it played out while you were making the documentary, and it continues to play out right now, playing on that resentment of immigrants. That wasn't what was going on with Roosevelt exactly. Somehow, we always inevitably, when we talk about Jews and the Holocaust, the U.S. and the Holocaust, come around to FDR a little bit. He could have made different decisions. Do you think there was ever a chance that he would have?
Well, FDR is obviously a centrally important figure and character when exploring this topic. And I think what we learned over the course of making the film and doing the research and speaking to the scholars is just to remember that he's, you know, the president of the United States and has enormous power, but he's also has a Congress and an electorate and a domestic crisis, and he's juggling the military crisis as well as a humanitarian one. And I don't want to then, you know, let him, I don't think the film does, and I don't think we, Lynn, will probably want to speak to this too, let him off the hook for the fact that we could have, as a nation, under his leadership, done more, particularly in the years leading up to the start of the Second World War in Europe and then our involvement in it after 1941. So it's deeply important to understand the complexities of the circumstances in front of the Roosevelt administration and how anti-Semitic the State Department was.
Yeah.
And yet how many Jews, I mean, the opposite was also true, right? The other side accused him of being Jewish himself. So, right. You know, it was political back then. And Lynn always says, you know, he's a hard president to fully understand because he didn't leave, you know, he doesn't have LBJ tapes and a lot of diary entries about why he did or didn't make certain decisions.
Right.
So, you know, I don't think we want to let him off the hook, and I don't think we want to entirely blame him. And somewhere in between those two things is what we're trying to get out in the film. Lynn, what am I missing?
Yeah, no, I think that's great. I mean, this is a central question. We talk about it a lot, and the more we talk about it, the more I find we can't fully land the plane on it because it isn't an easy question.
Exactly.
And one of the things that has been really striking is our desire to blame somebody for what happened. Obviously, the United States did not perpetrate the Holocaust, so we, first and foremost, the blame goes to the people who orchestrated it and executed to plan and murder millions of people. But why didn't we let in more people who were desperately trying to get here? Roosevelt is partly responsible for that. But, you know, I don't know. It's too easy to blame him in a way. And also to ascribe that there is responsibility on his death, which I agree with Sarah, there is. I think it's also too simple to say that Roosevelt was anti-Semitic. That sort of lets the whole country off the hook, because, I mean, that's one thing I will say I learned in making this film, was just how profoundly anti-Semitic America was during this time. And the Father Coughlin, the radio priest, yeah, Charles Lindbergh, public figures, you know, who are mainstream, well-respected icons of American society, were espousing a kind of anti-Semitism. Henry Ford, let's not forget Henry Ford, you know, a mainstreaming of kind of a bigotry and othering that Roosevelt had to deal with. So, you know, one of the things surprising was to see that when he's speaking to the public about what we're fighting for, what's at stake, you know, what is the threat of Nazism and fascism, he almost never speaks directly about the persecution of the Jews. It's a much broader kind of framing of the problem. And it's not because he doesn't understand what's at stake, it's because he understands, I think, and we can't prove this, that if he were to frame the struggle as an existential crisis facing the Jews of Europe, the American public would not be on board with doing anything about that.
You both have worked on all kinds of important documentaries, baseball, Hemingway, the Vietnam War, now LBJ. Was this a more personal experience for you, working on something that was so profoundly impacted the Jewish community and the Jews of the world?
Yes, we both want to answer that. I'll go first. I mean, on the one hand, yes, very deeply personal. My father's family came here after the war. My father was a refugee, and thanks to the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, they came here, and thanks to the joint, my great-grandparents got to Mexico City, and another wing of cousins went to Brazil. So this specific history is very personal to me. Having said that, you know, the amount that I learned about the refugee crisis, the American response to the Holocaust, what Americans knew and when they knew it, is surprising, and also just how deeply patriotic and grateful to America my grandparents were, and when my great-grandparents finally got here, they were, and my father and my aunt and my uncle always have been. So yes, it's very personal. Yes, I have some direct family connections to this topic, but honestly, you know, we're a very diverse and inclusive team making the film, and I think that is really rewarding regardless of the topic, Vietnam, Hemingway. And like Lynn was saying earlier, we sort of approach each subject the same way, you know, those of us who do and don't have different personal connections. And so it's a little bit of both for me personally, and I wish my grandparents were alive to see the film, just because I would be so curious to talk to them about it. And I feel grateful to have had the opportunity to work on a subject that is important to my family history and for my children to know about. But, you know, that's, It's all things for me, actually, I would say.
Yeah. I beautifully said, you know, in a way, every film is personal. It's interesting, yeah, in that we get very intellectually and emotionally and spiritually and philosophically involved with trying to make history real to ourselves so that we can make it real for our viewers. And so that's, you know, we do that in different ways. Part of it is meeting the people who live through it and having the privilege of hearing them bear witness in an interview. Part of it is looking at the archival material and trying to, you know, make it come alive as it was once real, and working with the scholars who, you know this topic inside out and help us sort of see the bigger picture and what the details, how everything kind of fits together. So that's true for any project, and this one, that is absolutely true for me, that the personal part was sort of trying to understand, which I never had really thought about, how does my family story fit into this question of who is allowed, who's welcomed in America, because most of my forebears came here before 1924. All of my forebears came before 1924, excuse me. And my father's parents in particular, if they had waited or come here not as children but tried to come as adults, they wouldn't have been able to. And then I wouldn't be here. And I didn't understand that until we started working on this film. And I didn't understand that I had distant relatives in some of the places where some of the worst killing happened, in Ukraine, Belarus, those parts of the sort of Soviet Union, Poland, Ukraine, that area of the world. I didn't have any concept of that growing up in New York City, sort of several generations after the fact. So it was personal, but not in the way that it's personal for Sarah. It's a little bit different for me.
I want to thank Lynn Novick and Sarah Botstein for a great visit here on Too Jewish. We can go on for a great deal longer, but people need to go see the film. Tell us where people can go to find out more about the U.S. and the Holocaust, where they could view it, and where they could find out more about the two of you.
You can find out all kinds of things about the film on pbs.org/Ken Burns the Holocaust. Some combination of those words gets you there, I noticed this morning. And it will be streaming free on all PBS platforms for the next 4 weeks. And then our stuff after that is easily available on Amazon. So there's lots to learn. We're going to be continuing to add essays and conversations and content from the film onto the website, and really hope people take advantage of the streaming window. And for teachers and anybody interested in the educational materials, if you go to PBS Learning Media and the Ken Burns Classroom, you can see the lesson plans that were created to go in concert with the series for middle and high school students.
Thank you both so much. Really appreciate it. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Suzette Schiff, the youngest guest ever on the 20-year history of Too Jewish. She's a 16-year-old author of a young adult novel on the Holocaust, Running for Shelter. And don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha for the joyous holiday of Sukkot this week. Services tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m. This Friday night, services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Lots of great Sukkot stuff, lulav and etrog, a sukkah. And Saturday morning, too, for Shabbat Sukkot, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, Ecclesiastes and Kiddush, live in person and available on our Facebook page. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org for information on how to join our wonderful congregation. Our playout this morning comes for the holiday of Sukkot, starting tonight at sunset, continuing for a joyous week of meals, friends, and outdoor joy. It's Benny Friedman singing Adi Ron's beautiful song, Atah HaKadosh. I am small, but you, God, are holy. From the classic Sukkot film, Ushpizin. If you haven't seen it recently, find it online and watch it again for Sukkot this year. It's fabulous. My friends, have a Chag Sukkot Sameach, a happy holiday of Sukkot, Moadim L'Simcha, a festival of joy, and a Shavua Tov, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
אין אותם לכחש, התרבות הזאת לא לנו, כי בליבנו יש מעני הקטן, השפל שבין כולם, ומתו נראה ונדה. מעני הקטן, האחרון שבעם עומד או נרגש ונפרד.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.